You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It's curtains up on another episode of West of Broadway, a celebration of musical theater on the West Coast. I'm Will Armstrong.
And I'm Wendy Rosoff.
And we are so grateful for you to join us again for a wonderful conversation about musical theater in Los Angeles. So today, Wendy, I'm so excited because we're going to be talking with a special guest lecturer and educator at the Pasadena Playhouse.
Yes.
It's really, really cool. Pasadena Playhouse is one of my favorite theaters in town.
Me too. I love it so much. And this conversation, the idea of this conversation, brings out the total theater nerd in me. I cannot wait to pick our guest. Brain.
Yes. His class is called The Broadway Musical and America. And I feel like it combines two of my favorite things. One, politics, and two, musical theater. And so I'm really excited. Our guest today is Adam Epstein, and he is a very successful Broadway producer and a very interesting guy. I've been doing a lot of research on him, and I can't wait to introduce him to everyone. But first, how are you doing it's been a month and a half of a lockdown.
Yeah.
How's everything going?
Good. I'm fine, you know, ups and downs, but I feel good. I'm healthy. Me and my loved ones are safe and good. And, you know, so just living my best life. And you?
I tried to cut my hair today and it did not go well. And and I'm becoming a survivalist. Okay, so I have this amazing lemon tree in my yard, and I make lemonade and I use it for cooking and everything, and I love it. And I bought chickens. I have 4 chickens that I'm raising so I can raise my own eggs.
Can we talk about what you named those chickens?
Well, okay, if you listen to the show, I often will work RuPaul and RuPaul's Drag Race into my narrative. I've been doing it since we started the show. I'm obsessed with it. I look forward to it. I've seen every episode many times. I named them Katya, Trixie, Shangela, and Heidi, which are 4 drag queens from RuPaul's Drag Race. And each one of them has a little personality, which is very, they remind me of these.
Oh my gosh. I cannot wait to meet these guys once this is all over.
It's okay. So you're a vegetarian and you have been for years.
Yes.
And I'm an omnivore and I am experiencing
having some issues,
some guilt. You know, I didn't realize how affectionate and intelligent and it's making me rethink a couple things. Yeah,
maybe this will be yet another big change that comes about due to quarantine. Who knows?
Who knows? But I'm open to it.
Anything is possible.
Exactly. And then I think once I get, because my coop, they're in a container now and because they're so little, but yeah. I ordered a legit coop and I'm going to be building that next week.
Wait, you
but
have to build once, it?
Well, I mean, put it together.
Oh, you know? Okay. I mean, it's an IKEA coop situation?
It's a coop kit.
A coop kit. Of course.
And which is fitting because we're all cooped up over here. So I'm going to be legit cooped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so there's that. And then once that gets situated, I have this plan because I live in a little house and we have a flat roof and I want to put a structure on the roof and I want to buy 1 or 2, wading pools and fill them with soil and have vegetable gardens on the roof. I'm becoming a doomsday prepper.
That is amazing.
I want to grow my own produce and vegetables, and I want to raise my own chicken eggs. And like I said, I have my lemons, and then I'll be like, and then I'll just, oh, and then my friend Gary, he keeps bees, and he told me he'd give me bees.
No, that's where I draw the line. No bees.
I'm scared of bees too.
You know what? Bees sting dogs too, if that does anything for you.
Oh, yeah. One of my dogs got stung in the mouth one time and she swelled up so bad.
Yeah, Bruno, my Yorkie, got stung on the tail one time when we were in Ojai at the Ojai Valley Inn and Spa. We were having like a very zhuzhy weekend and we went to like little meow meow lavender gardens and Bruno was like romping through the lavender and all of a sudden he was like, rah! And he came out of there and like was running in circles. We get back to our, you know, like yummy Shangri-La room and Bruno's tail was like a ball. And for the rest of the weekend, it became all about Bruno's tail and nursing him back to health.
Yeah, that's, I mean.
No bees.
Yeah, okay, no bees. All right, but yeah, I'll find, yeah. So, but I feel like I have my hands full already. I need to
stop.
Yeah,
you do.
I mean, idle hands are the devil's playground, so I like to keep my hands busy, I guess. But yeah. So, I think we're ready to bring on our guest.
I'm so excited. Let's do it.
Adam Epstein, welcome to West of Broadway.
Thank you for having me. Hi, Will. Hi, Wendy.
Hello. We are so happy to have you with us today.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here, to be joining you and talking about all things musical theater, right? What else?
Yes.
Exactly.
What else? Well, I would love to hear a little bit about your background.
Sure. So I have something of a hybrid background. Where I am now is not where I once was, but I still keep myself, I guess, once a theater boy, always a theater boy. Basically, in summation, I was originally a musical theater performer at NYU, midway through, about sophomore year, I went and got my undergraduate degree in political theory because I always had a tremendous interest in political science, and I didn't want to be a performer, and I thought I was going to go the route I kind of am going now, but I still had that irresistible tug toward the arts and especially the theater, and I had to find a way to channel it. So when I graduated, rather than going the acting route, I took an unpaid casting internship at what was known as the Johnson Liff Casting Agency.
Oh.
Remember Vinnie Liff and Jeffrey Johnson? Yeah, they were kind of like mentors to me, and it was an unpaid internship. I was right out of college. I applied. Heaven knows why they took me then. It wasn't like I didn't need an offer, but I really enjoyed my time there and learned a lot about that side of the business. And one day Jeffrey Johnson came into the room. I was sitting and filing pictures and doing my little chores, if you will. And he said, "What do you want to do with your life?" And I said, "Well, I don't want to be a casting director." I just wasn't what I want to do. He said, "You should be a producer." He goes, "You've got moxie. I like your way. Let me make some calls." And he ended up helping me get a job with the late, great Marty Richards. Wow. Marty Richards, who produced the original Chicago, Sweeney Todd, La Cage aux Folles, Grand Hotel, on and on, and the movie of Chicago, too. And I joined the firm as a young production associate when they were working on the musical The Life, the Cy Coleman musical, which was the 1996-97 Broadway season. And it just felt like I had found my calling, you know? It felt that I could be in a creative profession. I was able to use my mind. I mean, I didn't necessarily want to be a businessman per se, but it sort of certainly built those tools for me. And after about a year and a few months there, I was like, I think I'm going to try to do this on my own. I'm 23. What do I have to lose? Sounds totally insane. And I associate produced a roundabout production of A View from the Bridge. It was the revival that Anthony LaPaglia, a pre-West Wing Allison Janney, and a sadly deceased Brittany Murphy was in, directed by the great Michael Mayer, and it turned out to be a tremendous hit. I joined the team, and I was off and running, and that led to, don't ask me how, through most of my 20s, just one thing after the other. I wound up doing Amadeus in the West End and on Broadway, and then subsequently I did the Boston first national sit down of I Love Your Perfect Now Change. And that led me to another Arthur Miller. I did The Crucible with Liam Neeson and Laura Linney. And along the way, I was blessed to meet a mentor who also passed this year, not from COVID, but also from actually a lung related illness, partially, Margot Lyon.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a legend in theater. Actually, it wasn't lung related, I'm sorry, but she had lung problems. But it's just curious that she died shortly before COVID hit. But anyway, she had the idea, sick with the flu one day, that Hairspray might make a good idea as a musical. And I know I'm kind of fast forwarding through this, but then she called me up and said, we had been talking for about 6 months and she had really wanted me to have a chance to produce with her. And, you know, I had a lot of credits at that point, but I wanted to do a big musical. And she said, what about Hairspray? And I said, yeah, let's do it. It just felt right. And I was there from the beginning, put together the team. And, you know, and that was really the game changer, because at 27 going on 28, I sort of had opportunities I wouldn't have otherwise had.
Yeah.
You know, and then I was able to do The Wedding Singer. And then I did another John Waters musical, Cry Baby, which was as big a flop as Hairspray was a hit. And I'm proud to say that, because John Waters famously said during the Cry Baby experience, well, we've been to the top of the mountain, the bottom of the valley. And I love John, still a good friend. And you know what? It was, had Cry Baby not, that experience not been so rough, I might not have hit the pause button, because I did at that point. I'd been producing for like 12 years. I was 34, obviously not old. Wow. I'm 45 now, but I really realized there were other things I wanted to do, and I didn't love the game anymore. Not that I didn't love the theater, I didn't love the game of producing. Mm. And I make that distinction, which is why I think when I ended up going back to graduate school and getting a master's degree in American studies, and which was wonderful, and kind of it continuing to build my life I became a writer for various websites, and one thing led to the other, and I got into the world of political media. I realized there was a reason that happened, because there's sort of, I want to sit at the intersection, I guess, of politics and media, or politics and entertainment. Sure. And because I went and really thought about what the musical meant as an American art form, and how to frame that as part of American studies in academia, is basically defined as a sort of study of American culture, politics, and history writ large. So you end up with this sort of look at it. You know, somebody might study the indigenous movement in New Mexico in the 1800s, or somebody might study, you know, what does it mean? What are feminist politics? I mean, anything. Somebody might study the history of blackface in American culture, for example, you know, and musical theater fits in as what they call performance studies. And a lot of the people who nurtured me intellectually when I was at Brown, which is where I went to graduate school, were like, you know, this is an unexplored area. And a lot of academics who've done it, a lot of academics haven't done it. A lot of people don't have, it's something that requires such a deep experience, not just a theory.
Right.
You know, because that's what you have to know. Anyway, so that kind of sparked a plug, and that's where I'm driving at. It led me to not only my current career in political media, but when I got back from graduate school, Danny Feldman from Pasadena Playhouse called me, and this is back in 2017, and said, how about putting some kind of class together? Basically the musical theater, the study of, that's why I call it the Broadway musical in America. And it looks at the musical from Oklahoma to today, but also reminds people, you know, how the musical evolved and how our politics and culture both informed those musicals, and how the musicals reflected the anxieties of those times.
Yeah,
it's sort of a wonderful two-way street. So
that's amazing. Fascinating.
No, absolutely.
I know it's a lot in one sentence, but I figured I would get there. You know.
No, and thank you so much for the detailed description. I mean, it's I have such an appreciation for and a love of musical theater, but also I love this country and I love politics. And right now I'm fascinated. I don't think there's a time when MSNBC or CNN isn't playing in my house, because I'm just fascinated with, but to see how through time, how the theater and entertainment is, it's like holding a mirror up to what's going on at our country. And to be able to break that down, it's like, this is such an exciting, so originally, was this supposed to be an in-person class that they were offering?
Well, it was conceived as an in-person class. I taught it the fall of 2017, the spring of 2018, and the spring of 2019. Danny and I in the Playhouse actually had been talking about doing a digital version just so it would have a broader reach.
Mm-hmm.
And we had not planned, I had not planned on doing it in person this spring, just because I have other media commitments and it required me to be there every Monday night, although I loved every minute of it. But COVID hit and he said, what about Zooming it? And I said, that's fabulous, because A, you know, we can already get many more people than we would get in the room we did it. Plus, you know, getting to Pasadena Monday nights, I mean, we always did well with it, but there were a lot of people that wanted to take it but couldn't commit to, let's say, 11 or 12 Mondays. And if you're not going to be there in person, what's the point with Zoom? Although it's not required, it's preferred that you're Zooming while I'm doing it. If you've paid for the class, you can go back and watch it.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So yeah, so that's something that people should know, that like people worried about the commitment of it. And by the way, it's only an hour every Tuesday night, and I'm going to Zoom guests in, and the lectures are stimulating, and as much as we can interact, there's gonna be a lot of people, so I won't be able to do as much question and answer. But what's great about that is if you miss it, you can watch it at your own leisure, as long as you've paid for the class. And that's an important point to stress. So, you know, we've had a very good reception so far, but we want to keep selling. And I don't want people to think like, oh, you know, I don't want to pay for this and miss three classes. You won't miss it. It's good.
Yeah. No, that's incredible. Good. I read through your syllabus and I want to take it.
Take it.
I really want to.
It's a lot of fun. And I kind of, you see the way I crafted, you know, Oklahoma being the game changer that everybody knows about. It's some of these beaten to death motifs about, song and dance are integrated, all of which is true. But it was a game changer for what American culture meant at the time and where the world was, where America sat at the world. Because when Oklahoma opened in 1943, the country was at war. And Oklahoma, right, was like the arrival and discovery, so the story tells you, of impending statehood, right? Of community, of a new addition. You know we belong to the land we belong to is grand. And that channeled the kind of patriotism that was infusing the body politic at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, and people went to that show almost with patriotic duty, almost as a calling. Ooh. So while the musical could be viewed as, you know, which guy's going to take Lori to the box social, the musical is about a lot more than that. And people in war-torn America, or wartime America, I should say, look to it as a kind of solace, you know, a refuge. So it has a place both in the form and the politics, which is a great way to start when you're thinking about what the American musical means.
Yeah, I mean, so many
of the uniquely American art forms, you know.
I was going to say, so many of the musicals, not only that you've produced, but also that I saw listed on your syllabus, in some way or another, are a reflection of the time of politics. Even Annie, you know, Herbert Hoover, you know, that period of time, the Great Depression, and everything that was going on in New York during that time. I'm a native New Yorker. And so, I mean,
I lived there 16 years, so I'm not a native New Yorker, but it's certainly in maybe not the DNA, I guess it's in the blood, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, and Hairspray, of course, is based on the real segregation in Baltimore. Absolutely. I mean, it's so fascinating.
I mean, John Waters came up with the characters from Hairspray for the original film. It's had so many iterations. The original film with Divine in 88, in his bedroom by watching the Buddy Dean show. The Buddy Dean show is what the Corny Collins show is. And American Bandstand had that show out of Philadelphia had replicas in Cleveland and Detroit. All the cities had their own little local show. And you'd come home and there literally was a segregated setup, and there was a Negro Day. That was a real thing. And there was a who's going to get the crown, you know, type of dance. And so, you know, and you could also see, John said, like, you know, the sort of hormonal love among the, you know, you could see the girl and the guy kind of swooning, you know, hence the kind of Link Larkin character. So it's all based in something, and it sort of feels like it's imagery, but he was watching those shows in his bedroom and creating that gallery of lovable characters.
So you, the Broadway musical in America, you're uniquely qualified for many reasons to be teaching this, but the politics part, doesn't that come, isn't that ingrained in part of your family? Don't you come from a political family?
Well, I come from, it's interesting, somewhat. My mom's father, my paternal grandfather, who, my grandmother is 100. She's still with us. Her husband, who died at 90, was a very prominent judge and philanthropist in Miami, where I'm from. But yes, he was a delegate to Adlai Stevenson at the Democratic National Convention in 1956.
Amazing.
He was Hubert Humphrey's 1968 Dade County campaign manager, Hubert Humphrey, who sadly did not beat Nixon that year. Mm-hmm. But and he helped nurture the careers of many of the Florida politicians. I worked for Senator Bob Graham because my grandfather helped me get elected governor, a guy named Leroy Collins, Lawton Childs. He was a who's who in Florida politics, although he himself never ran. He was, you know, both a judge and activist and, you know, part of the, you know, a great, what you'd call FDR Democrat of the old school, you know, wanted, in those days, although you know, the South was largely Democratic. It was Democratic for racial reasons, but the Democrats held control most of those places. And Democrats, as long as you had a D by your name, you could have a better chance of getting elected in Florida than a Republican, believe it or not. Even if you were to the left of, you know, the kind of conservative prevailing view that many Southern Democrats had then. If you're a Republican, you know, ever since the end of Reconstruction, you had no chance. That R by your name was lethal, which is why if you look even into the 90s, you'll see still Democratic senators in Louisiana and Alabama and all that, because it was just an ingrained thing. Mm. Registered Democrats in many of those Southern places outnumbered registered Republicans. The fact that they're so deep red, and though they were going red in presidential elections, they were still sending Democrats to the House and Senate. It's fascinating.
It sounds yes. like there's as much theater in politics as there is the politics that you were saying in theater.
Well, my God, I mean, I think that for better or worse, and it's not actually for better, it's for worse, Trump's ability to perform has been the chief reason he has been able to survive. And I believe that, but more than anything, and although there's a stew of it, from race and gender to populist backlash to Hillary's bad campaign to all those things. But Trump, whether he meant to or not, exploited what I think has been the very, the unintended consequences of celebrity culture. Because that's what he is. Yeah. And although we don't like him, those of us who are decent minded, and that includes a lot of Republicans, he is a TV star.
Yeah.
And a lot of people in an uninformed country saw him as, okay, well, maybe he can make a change. He was on The Apprentice. I mean, remember, I always tell people who follow this, you're too smart. Don't overthink it. Politics is a broad brush business, and it's often, sadly, not a policy contest.
Yeah. Terrifying.
Terrifying. That's why we are where we are. That's why the imagery, listen, since the age of television, imagery, looks, all of that matters, which is why, you know, when people say, you got to take this position or that position, I always say, if you've got the stardom of Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, you have a winner. I don't care what the hell they say. I mean, they can't say just anything they want. But right. But what I mean is, when you have a candidate like John Kerry, and to a certain extent, Hillary Clinton, that have problems in selling their brand, yeah. It's like anything. It's not going to be an easy climb, you know. This is an unusual time now, so we'll see what happens. But Trump's an incumbent, but overseeing the worst economy and obviously a pandemic. And Joe Biden is less than ideal, but he's qualified, experienced. He's got great character, probably poised to win, but we don't know.
Well, I feel like I was just having this conversation right before we started this interview. I feel like if he surrounds himself, if he pads himself with power players, and I hear that there's, you know, his committee for the vice president, he's already putting that together, and I feel like it's going to be a woman. I mean, that's what everything points yes. towards, whether it's an African-American woman or Caucasian, whoever it is. If he pads himself with the right people, I feel like that is going to empower him so much in this election.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, listen, I think, sadly, to lose this many people and watch an economy 10 years of economic growth crater in a month or two is awful, and the human toll can't be minimized. But, you know, if it proves to be the undoing of an incumbent president as manifestly unfit as Donald Trump, then I think we have something to be proud of, you know. Proud that this disease happened, proud right. that he exactly. has been unseated. For the listeners, I don't want to be misquoted.
Right. Yes. Of course. But I secretly love that this has become a bit of a political podcast.
I'm so into it. I'm so into it.
Well, I don't, for the record, when I teach the class, obviously, take political positions.
Sure.
But I do frame them in the time, per the class, when company comes along in 1970. What ends up happening is the culture has anxiety, right? The anxiety of that musical, though it has quite a bit of hope in it, but the sort of urban angst of what it meant to be a New Yorker in 1970, yep. this culture was reflecting back the anxiety of Vietnam and post-civil rights and eventually Watergate 4 years later of a society that from World War II till about the late 60s was robust in its economic growth. Standard of living was increasing, wages were rising, and we seemed to be becoming what we had always hoped to be, the real beacon of hope, you know, the American exceptionalism we all hear about. And that became distressed by the late 60s, early 70s. And it's no accident, I don't think, whether it's being reflected back or the anxiety is being telegraphed by the audience or by the creators, that Sondheim embarked on the companies and Night Musics and Follies and Pacific Overtures. I mean, who writes a musical about imperialism in Japan but Stephen Sondheim? And, you know, a macabre killer seeking revenge, you know, in Victorian England. I mean, all those things become reflections, which is why Annie's in the course, because by 1977, right, there's a major recession going on. We've had Watergate. We've had the end of Vietnam. The last helicopter leaves Saigon in April of 75. And in comes, you know, cotton candy on a stick to say the sun will come out tomorrow, while smartly still depicting social satire. Hooverville's is a brilliant number, you know, telegraphing. That's a real sharp political satire. And, but, you know, there was something, not only because it's such a well-made musical in book and score, but about a little moppet of red hair and a red dress, a little girl with her dog standing center stage, no irony, singing, you know, just thinking about tomorrow. It's only a day away. There was something that really felt like to audiences then, when I was only three, but for people who saw it in its day, you know, like an oasis, you know, and a bit of hope in a very dark time. So again, it goes, it's not one theme or the other, but you can sort of trace American anxiety either in the musical or as a response to it. Annie was a response to it, you know, and then of course the British invasion comes along. Our Champion dies in 1980, which is not just symbolic. I mean, that was the end of that era. You know, we lose Bob Fosse and Michael Bennett in the same year. Of course, that's 1987, but, you know, thankfully Bennett still had Dreamgirls to do, but, you know, most of their best work was behind them, in the British mega musical sort of, as I say, recolonizes the colonies and comes in and sweeps in and becomes the mainstay of Broadway. And that's all you had in those days. You know, you had other shows. You had Dreamgirls, you had Sending the Park with George, you had La Cage, you had Into the Woods, of course. You know, you had Big River and a lot of things in the 80s. But, you know, you see that trend, and then you see the 90s go into, you know, the explosion of Rent and Ragtime and Bringing the Noise, Bringing the Funk, and sort of the musical Kiss, the Spider Woman, Tommy, all sorts of different things happening up until 9/11 happens. Right. And then Mamma Mia makes it to America right after that. And then come the producers and Hairspray. And they were returned to what felt like the golden age of the musical comedy, when not just New York, but the country needed it most, especially Hairspray. But the producers were one, you know, one hell of a knockout, too, because it was the 1-2 punch of showbiz gold and Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
You know, and the classic musical kind of reinvigorated with two immensely appealing stars at the center. So, yeah.
I could talk to you all day long.
Seriously, your passion for musical theater just warms my heart, and it's
well, I've been a Broadway baby a long time.
Same here,
and it's so nice to talk to a kindred soul. Even all the way back to the beginning of our conversation, Johnson Liff and Hughes Moss were my two champions.
Julie Hughes and Barry Moss.
They were my two champions, two casting house champions when I first
came. They were the out. That was really them. They were the two biggies. Right?
I know, and I was so fortunate, and I haven't heard their names in such a long time. And when you said Johnson Liff, it just brought me back to this whole...
Listen, Johnson Liff, you know, you may remember this. Before they were the go-to for Andrew Lloyd Webber and Karen McIntosh, they cast the original Wiz, they cast the original Amadeus, they cast the original Dreamgirls, they cast the original Dracula, Frank Langella. I mean, they were... You know, and they actually, their last show was The Producers. That was the end. I mean, they went through all that era, you know, it was right before Hairspray, because we started developing it and we had already signed up with Bernie Telsey. But I was pretty close to, like, you know, wanting to say, well, shouldn't Johnson Liff do this? But nonetheless, they were legends. And they came out of David Merrick's casting office. David Merrick had an in-house casting office, and they were the associates for Otto Windsor, a woman named Jerry Windsor.
Wow, I didn't know that.
First name. Yeah. And also Christian Slater's mother was a
Mary Jo, right?
Mary, was a casting director on Broadway with them too. It's funny, huh?
Yeah,
a lot of history.
Crazy.
I know.
Yeah, I've followed David Merrick and his history for quite some time. Although I read excerpts of The Abominable Showman, but I've not read the whole thing. I know. I want to. We're actually a friend and I are crafting a parody musical of something, and one of the roles is crafted after David Merrick, and so I've been going back in. I have to pick up the book, but you know, my first very large job when I started was 42nd Street, which is actually how Will and I initially met. We did the Broadway revival, but I actually started European tour.
Well, then you know all about that. Was Merrick's creation.
Yes. And one of the first things that happened was we got sat down first day of rehearsal and, you know, the original production stage manager of the Broadway 42nd Street, the original, had become the director of this European tour. And the original dance captain was the choreographer, right? And so we got sat down and got told, you know, it was like a fireside chat of David Merrick stories. So I've been kind of obsessed.
And Randy Skinner restaged that.
Randy did the revival. Yep. And of course, many, many iterations before and since.
Well, there's my favorite David Merrick story about 42nd Street is in that 42nd Street, you remember, ran from 1980 to 1989. Mm-hmm. Phantom of the Opera. It opened at the Winter Garden and then it transferred to the Majestic. Okay. But Phantom of the Opera came in. And, you know, and then they moved it to the St. James. Mm-hmm. And Phantom of the Opera was sold out from here to Kingdom Come. And you remember, and 42nd Street was in its final year after having obviously a huge run. And there would always be a line out in front of Phantom of people waiting for just for tickets and everything, right. Returns. So David Merrick took the usual 8 o'clock curtain, moved the 42nd Street curtain to 8:30 because it was across, the St. James is across the street from Majestic. This is why he was the best, and took out an ad with himself in the picture, right? We don't have this anymore, but it's my favorite thing in the world. Pointing his finger, say, David Merrick is holding the curtain for you.
Wow.
42nd Street now at 8:30, and he ran the show another year.
Wow.
Because he said, hey, I can sell enough tickets at the booth. I have enough inventory, TDF, tourists. Guess what? All those Phantom refugees are going to come across the street and say, what do I do? It's 8 o'clock. I think, you know, you can't get it. It's 10:55 and then you've already missed everything. He said, come across the street.
What a shrewd move. How amazing is that?
David Margolick of St. Louis, Missouri.
Yes. Yes. Incredible. Can we do a quick lightning round with you? Quick question.
Oh, sure.
All right. Are you ready?
Lightning round. I'm ready. Lightning.
Here we go. Your favorite musical of all time?
Gypsy.
Your favorite movie of all time?
Toss up between Goodfellas and The Wizard of Oz.
Ooh. A performer who inspired you growing up?
Carol Burnett.
Who would you like to work with?
In any capacity?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's a good one. Oh, my God. I would like to work with Jonathan Groff.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
Why?
Because I'm so impressed that he is a genuine Broadway baby, but can go and do something as brilliant as Mindhunters on Netflix or Mindhunter and be equally as compelling at that. I think he and I think he moves effortlessly between worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And if I ever go back to the theater, it's going to be as someone who adapts classic plays or as the director like Hal Prince did.
Yeah.
And he is a kind of actor I would love to work with because I understand. I feel that he's so malleable and his choices are so interesting. And he broke that mold. I mean, you could see him as Seymour Little Shop of Horrors and then he's in some Netflix series about serial killers. I mean, it's very rare that you see that kind of range. So, you know, it's probably other people I'm forgetting right now.
Yeah, that's a good one.
No, I love that.
But I he would be someone I would either cast if I were directing or hire if I were producing or work yeah. with. I think it seems like a genuinely nice guy. I know a lot of people don't know him, but he also seems sweet. So anyway.
Great, I love that. Okay, so name a Barbie dream project that you would like to work on. I guess that would be theater. I know that you're away from it for now, but
yeah.
what is something?
I mean, one of the things I'd like to do, because I am an English major and a political science major. I was actually political theory and literature, and my American studies emphasis was on the American lit works of the 19th century. There are classic American pieces, and I mean, most famously, The Heiress by Henry James was mm-hmm. Washington Square, but I would like to adapt and or direct something, some of the classic American lit by Hawthorne or Melville or even other authors and make a really sexy play version out of them, cast it with top tier talent, and have it done on Broadway because it's seldom done. And they would, and some of those, again, adapted correctly would be great plays. And I've been inspired to do it by Richard Eyre, who directed my version of The Crucible, who ran the National Theater, because mm-hmm. he often takes Ibsen, took the beautiful Ibsen play Ghosts when I was, I lived in London for 2 years. I left that out 2014 to 16 because I was engaged and living over there. And I saw obviously tons of theater and produced over there. He did Ibsen's Ghosts, which he both adapted and directed with Leslie Manville, 90 minutes. It won all the Oliviers. And I believe there would be a place to do that. That'd be something that, as much as I love musicals, I did a lot of plays in my life. Yeah. And I'm a man of, I love text. And I learned from Peter Hall and Richard Eyre. And I love English and I language, that I would love to work on something like that. I don't know exactly which one, but even if I was the co-collaborator or directed it, I mean, my God, doesn't Hester Prynne need to be on Broadway? Come on.
Yeah.
Yes, she does.
Heck yeah.
All right. What was, I think you touched on this briefly, but what was your first big gig? What was the first gig that kind of like turned the needle for you?
The Life. I mean, The Life was, I'm not a full producer on it. I was a production associate or producing associate, whatever they called it. I mean, View from the Bridge was my first gig on my own when I was an associate producer and billed as such on the title page like that. But that was really what set it off. And then of course, you know, Amadeus was my first Tony nomination, so that led to something else. But then, of course, nothing could compete with the magic of Hairspray, because a hit of that magnitude opens up so many doors. I mean, Hairspray opened up doors to me in my media world that have nothing to do with Hairspray. You know, it's just such a, you don't realize at the time, you know, that a hit musical really does, and one that lived on like that has continued to be so evergreen, you know. Yeah. It remains sort of fresh in people's minds. And so, but I would say The Life was like the, obviously the thing that got me in the river, in the pond, whatever you want to call it.
Okay. What piece, this is the last one. What piece of advice would you offer to your younger self?
Everything changes.
Ooh.
And enjoy that. And it's important. The only thing only permanence is impermanence. So ride the wave and know that, and maybe slow down a little bit. I mean, I love that I was ambitious, but there were parts of myself I think that I needed to work on, not terribly deficient parts, but we're all imperfect. And I would have liked to have had more time to breathe. And as I've gotten older, you know, though I'm no less busy, I manage my space and self-care in a better way, you know. But when you're 24 and you're a Broadway producer, you don't even know what the hell you're doing or how you got there. I'm not sure, even as much of an old soul I am, I'm not sure how much introspection could even have gotten me there that I otherwise would have needed through life's experiences.
Right.
Incredible stuff.
Adam Epstein, you are a delight. Thank you so much for being such a wonderful guest. And if you are looking for something to do 1 hour a week for 11 weeks from May 12th to July 21st, check out PasadenaPlayhouse.org and sign up for this class. And you'll see Wendy and I there too, I hope.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Thank you. I hope you guys take the class. Thank you for having me. This is a great podcast. I look forward to listening to other episodes.
And thank you so much.
About it. Yeah.
And I look forward to meeting you in person when this is all said and done.
I know, once we can. And I hope to, as I said, hope to see you both in the class. Everyone listening, take this class. It's 11 weeks of total joy. No previous knowledge required. No grades. So I know people like that. Trust me, for me too, I have to teach with grades. It's a pleasure not to have the drama of that. It'll just be learning and enrichment and engagement and fun.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, Adam Epstein, thank you so much.
Thanks, Will. Thanks, Wendy.
You take care.
Stay safe.
You too. Bye, guys.
I know I say this every time, but holy cow. That was an awesome interview, and he is a genius.
I know. I said it while we were in the interview, but I literally could talk to him all day and all night. He got like my juices flowing. Mm-hmm. I love how much he knows and how just fascinating it is to put the pieces together of the state of the world and politics and culture and theater and how one reflects the other. I mean, it's just, it's so powerful.
Yeah, I feel like I'm busted because I love musical theater so much and I love politics so much, but it's just like, he articulated it in such a beautiful way that I was just like,
I'm jacked up.
I need to learn more. I need to study more. I need to, I want to be able to just stats and figures and numbers and names and dates. And
are we going to take his class?
Oh, I would love
to. Let's take his class.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Okay. And if you're listening to this, it is PasadenaPlayhouse.org. Sign up for that class.
Like immediately, if not sooner, people.
It is wonderful. Yeah. Oh my God. What a great, great guy. Oh my gosh. Yeah. This is fun. Thank you again, Wendy. It's so much fun. And it's lovely to see your face. I miss you.
I miss you too. I miss you too.
And I miss everybody listening and watching and stuff like that. So yeah.
Thank you guys for watching.
Yeah. And so to keep up with us, like I said, our website is
WestonBroadwayPodcast.com.
And it should be launching very, very soon. But until then, we're at BroadwayPodcastNetwork.com and we're West of Broadway. And we're there with like 45 or 50 other incredible podcasts. So check us out and check out all of the rest of our family.
And you can also find us on BroadwayWorld.com.
Who we love. Thank you, Broadway World.
So much.
Sharing all of our content. Yeah. And you can find us on our social media channels. I'm Will Armstrong, PR.
I'm Wendy_Rosoff.
Yeah. And as always, if you're looking for us, you can find us
just west of Broadway. It's your big dramatic breath beforehand. I never know how long it's going to be. Just. All right. Bye, guys.
Bye. Yay, that was-
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.